Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoy the program. Well, how did you score it? That's the predominant question across the country tonight. Not a knockout to either side seems to be the general verdict. Lurking below, however, seems to be a general distaste for both sides. Tony Abbott fudges work choices, Julia Gillard fudges climate, and both seek to manipulate the soft underbelly on immigration and population. Is this one of those elections in which voluntary voting, if it were to be permitted in Australia, would declare a plague on both their houses? What do you think? You'll have your chance on ABC Radio nationally in just a few moments' time when we'll be joined by a panel of commentators representing some of the key welfare and religious agencies of the country to seek their opinion and yours. Are we getting the politics we deserve in 2010? Your turn to have your say. In our second hour tonight, politics and religion of another sort entirely. The world is watching the Catholic Church's public agony over clergy sexual abuse. Last week, the National Council of Priests of Australia invited one of the Church's most widely read commentators on the issue, American priest Father Donald Cozzens, author of a number of books, including The Changing Face of the Priesthood, to speak to them. And a rather intense session it proved to be. Well, tonight, Donald Cozzens joins us, together with Australian priest Father Michael Whelan, to assess the temperature of the debate, both in Australia and internationally. That's in about an hour's time. And of course, we have our usual features, the Midnight Quiz, Noel's Search for the Good Life, and the Chat Room, where this evening we'll be joined by Muslim commentator and lecturer at the University of Western Australia, Samina Yasmin. And one of the issues we might raise with Samina is the Liberal Party's removal today of the endorsement of a candidate for anti-Islamic sentiments. That's the Chat Room with Samina Yasmin in about 3 hours, if you can stand the pace. But first, this being Sunday night and having an interest in those things that concern many of our social and religious agencies, let me introduce our panel of commentators. Frank Quinlan is Executive Director of Catholic Social Services Australia. The National Director of Uniting Care Australia, Susan Hellyer, also joins us, both in our Canberra studio. Welcome to you both.
Thanks, John. Great to be here.
Good evening, John.
And in our Melbourne studios, Paul McDonald, recently appointed CEO of Anglicare Victoria. Paul, thanks for joining us for the first time.
Hi, John. Thanks.
Well, first let me ask you all about another issue that sprang up today and one that we'll possibly talk about later on in the evening. Tony Abbott's cancelling the endorsement of David Barker in the Sydney West seat of Chifley over remarks that were, well, anti-Muslim, and his expressed concerns over Julia Gillard's atheism. Do we have a parliamentary system in which one's religious beliefs should be taken into account? Frank Quinlan, do you want to have a go first?
Yeah, sure, John. Look, I think Tony was obviously acted swiftly and crisply to cut somebody loose who was sort of a bit at the edges. I'd be inclined to think in Australia today, where a modern and diverse and very pluralistic society, that we're one of the hallmarks of our success, I think, has been our acceptance of difference and our pluralism. And I think people would actually be encouraged to think that in the Parliament today, particularly given some of the worldwide issues, that perhaps to attract some more Muslim candidates might actually be something that was to be encouraged. And I would have thought, even on the question of Julia Gillard's belief and unbelief, I don't know Julia's heart personally, but I heard her explanation of her own sort of particular faith journey that said she'd grown up in a Christian household and had thought about things a bit, and she'd come to a decision of her own as an adult. And I would have thought that most of Australia would actually have a bit of sympathy with somebody of that views. You know, somebody who's struggled and thought about issues a bit. She's come to her own decisions, and people will make their own choice about whether they agree with that or not. But I think she's actually likely to be pretty reflective of a large part of the population, I would have thought.
Susan Hellyer, what about those Australians who point to things like, well, look, at the opening of every day in Parliament, they recite the Lord's Prayer. This is a symbol of belief in God and, in particular, a Christian heritage. So what Mr. Barker said is entirely consistent.
Oh, look, I think that we're in a modern Australia now where there's a Christian heritage certainly that we're built on. We're built on the heritage of the Indigenous peoples and their values and practices and beliefs. And we're also built on the practices and values and faiths that have come to Australia. And so it's quite appropriate in an open democracy. Everyone's entitled to participate and to be represented. And I think it's important that the leaders of our political parties can show their respect for different faiths and cultures.
Paul McDonald, just to quote Mr. Barker, the man who has been disendorsed by Tony Abbott, he said today, "I don't know if we want at this stage in Australian politics a Muslim in the parliament and an atheist running the government."
Well, I'm not sure if he's looked out the window lately about the diversity of Australian life. And basically, those sort of comments wouldn't go very far in any job interview in Australia, let alone a pre-selection interview. So you'd have to wonder how someone with those sort of views have got this far. But I think Tony Abbott has responded promptly and appropriately to the disendorsement, because you want Parliament reflecting the diverse and wide and varied views of the Australian population from both their religious background and also their religious beliefs or non-beliefs. And I think that he's really on a planet on his own, really, with some of the views that he's espoused today.
Well, let's move on to the great debate. I opened our program this evening by suggesting that the lukewarm response, both from the commentators after the program and apparently from The Worm and other things, may be an indicator that the public are not enamoured of the way the politics of this particular election campaign is being played out on both sides. Susan?
Look, it's interesting. I watched the debate with some friends, and I guess we were a bit bemused by The Worm, frankly. We wondered what it was measuring and what that meant in any real sense. I mean, it's a pretty shallow and it's a pretty kind of immediate point in time way of analysing things, and it doesn't actually tell us anything about what people are concerned about or what their expectations are of the government. And I just don't know whether it's really a strong basis for any decision-making about the leaders or the parties or how people are planning to vote.
Yes, and I understand that there was a bit of grumpiness in the Channel 9 studios. Laurie Oakes took exception to the way the Worm was being interpreted and basically said that, look, in his opinion, he couldn't agree with The Worm. So you even have one of the commentators falling out with The Worm immediately, and he was there supposed to be on the station that was running The Worm.
Well, John, I must say I turned back to the ABC after 5 minutes watching The Worm because it made me queasy, and I think it could have been replaced with Zeds there for a while. But I thought, aside from the the Worm factor, I thought it was a bit of a policy bypass today and tonight, and might have been curious and interesting about the personalities involved and get them getting themselves known to the Australian public, but it was a bit of a policy vacuum, really, in relation to anything decent or strongly said by either party.
Yes, go on.
No, sorry, John. I was only going to say that I think the anecdote you told about Laurie Oakes sort of gives the game away, really, I think, because largely the debate was set up and our sort of media coverage of the election, I think, is set up really, largely as a sort of trap set by journalists to have one of the major candidates sort of forget a number or stumble over a recollection of something or, formulate a form of words badly. I sat down before the debate and I thought, well, what do I really want out of this? How would somebody win my vote on this debate? And I wrote down things like vision and hope and insight into my circumstances and the things that I were concerned about. And I think what's happening in this election campaign, and I think the election debate tonight illustrates it, is that the media are possibly looking for something else, and I think that's a real challenge for us in terms of discussing the sorts of issues that we'd like to have discussed.
Yes, it's called gotcha journalism. Paul McDonald, do you think that's a significant influence?
Well, it is. It seems like the media have a bit to answer for about tonight's performance, because we spent 40 minutes talking about people who hadn't, you know, who weren't in the country, and it took us and you know, a sentence or two about some of the issues that matter. It's interesting that, well, first of all, it's a little wonder that Adam and Callum bumped Tony and Julia, because they're probably, you know, people are struggling to engage really with what either side are saying. And John, going back to 70s, 80s and 90s election campaigns, there used to be quite vigorous debates about health policy or welfare policy, Indigenous policy, taxation policy, these sorts of policies, real issues that matter. And at the moment, maybe we're all feeling a little bit too comfortable or lethargic, I don't know, but certainly it is bereft of some of these real tactile policies that were debated in these agenda-setting times, of which election campaigning is all about, is setting the agenda. And at the moment, I mean, I know we're only a week and a bit in, but I'm not sure where the light's been shone down the road for Australia to make a decision.
Is it because, in part, I'll get you all three to comment on this, is it because, in part, those big debates have been played out and we as electors know where those debates go? We know the rabbit holes to be run down. And so in a sense, we've become victims of the system too, in that we're basically looking for novelty where we really know there is no novelty. We've heard the brave rhetoric. We've heard the shallow answers. We're actually played out ourselves in this. And there's a factor there too.
John.
Well,
Susan.
Go on, Julie.
Yeah, sorry, John, I just wonder about how narrow the debate has become. Like, I'm not sure whether the debate actually reflects people's lives. You know, the things that people struggle with. I mean, what was talked about in the debate tonight was about, they talk about hospitals and they talked about schools. But other than that, I mean, even those things aren't the whole story around health and education and how they impact on people's lives. I mean, there was very little about cost of living. There was very little about jobs, the people who are missing out, you know, where do they factor in all of this? I just wonder whether the debate has narrowed down to what seems to be manageable, but it actually just misses the point for a lot of people and the kinds of lives they're trying to live with and the kinds of struggles that they face.
I think, John, if I can add that, I think the shape of it seems to be that our style of electioneering and election reporting seems to actually not deal well with some of those great debates as you described them, because I don't think some of them are solved, but neither do I think that they can be solved in a, you know, 6 or 8 second sound grab. So as Paul identified, you know, there was a lot of time tonight devoted to talking about boat people, and I couldn't help but think for every person who arrived in Australia on a boat last year, some 50 will be homeless tonight in Australia. But there's no simple solution to homelessness. It's not something that, you know, you can't just wave a wand and it be finished. So there are some really difficult discussions, long discussions for us to have about affordable housing and about land release and about a capital investment system that's structured on housing. They are going to be long and, you know, probably somewhat boring discussions. I think we desperately need to have them, but we can't have them in a half hour while people are watching their clocks looking for MasterChef to start.
The other thing that struck me watching this tonight was that, and I don't know why it hasn't struck me before in quite this way, here we were watching the only time at which the politicians appear on the national stage to discuss policy at any depth, shallow though it may be, in a way which 50 years ago was mandatory for every politician 5 or 6 times at least during the campaign in large public rallies where there were hundreds, if not thousands, of people in attendance. So there's a sense in which the whole political culture has narrowed.
You could easily devote a whole half hour to homelessness. You could easily devote a whole half hour to the mental health crisis that we're suffering. You could easily devote a whole half hour to people who are on very low incomes, who don't get any of the benefits of tax concessions because they're on allowances and so on. But we don't seem to be able to make room in our busy lives and in our busy media cycle for those long discussions.
Paul McDonald, when you're watching something like this, what are the big issues that you tick off and you just get incredibly frustrated that aren't being debated and you think reasonably should be?
Well, look, there's several. And I think, John, Australia's the eighth most richest country in the world, yet it's out of those 33 rich countries, we're the fifth most unequal. And when you start having a look at the separation between the top 20% and the bottom 20%, it's really the policies that can lift that bottom 20% up are the key ones. What are we going to do about unemployment, seeing that 25% of the unemployment rates are made up of 15 to 19? What about 500,000 children in jobless families? I mean, we are absolutely void of any vision for young people, especially those 40,000 that aren't in work or training or employment at all between 15 and 17. And the whole housing and homeless market, in which really, you know, vacancy rates for rental properties are around 1.6% vacancy rates. And the tightness on rental properties means that people, 26% of the homeless population are made up of families. So these are the real issues that I think we've got to... Government's role, and there are a handful of important roles that governments play, and one of those is actually dealing with lifting that bottom 20% up and in. And I think maybe we've drifted in which we're trying to champion middle Australia and pitch to middle Australia, in which really some of those policies are sharp as pillows, really, in relation to any traction they'll take in. But it's really that bottom 20%. I'm looking for real thinking about how to actually create a pathway for those who aren't in training, work or employment or at school at such a young age going into young adulthood. I'm looking for mental illness intervention, seeing that there's one in four young people that suffer mental illness. They're the type of issues, John, that I think I would have liked to see on the national stage played out.
Well, to give us just some idea of how difficult it is to drive such issues in policy terms these days in Australia, we're joined on the line at the moment by Graham West. Graham West, for those of you who don't know, in the rest of Australia, was a former minister in the Keneally government in New South Wales, resigned recently over his frustration at failing to get up a juvenile justice reform that was quite important to him. And he's declared that the parliamentary way is perhaps not the way for him, that he'd find it much easier or more satisfying to work at a local community level. Graham West, welcome to Sunday Night.
Good evening, John.
Graham, just how difficult is it for politicians these days to actually take a policy stance that leads the electorate based on knowledge and experience? So you tried and it seems eventually gave up on the parliamentary process on a vital question like juvenile justice.
Well, I think Frank may have identified it earlier, is that social policy takes a long time to actually bring people along with you. And one of the challenges with politics is not only are you there for a short period of time in terms of the election cycle, but of course the media cycle is probably less than a 24-hour cycle now with internet access to news. So you're actually fighting not only to get your message out in that media cycle, but also you've got a very short time to actually implement change. And social policy, it can take a number of years to actually get people to agree on what that social policy should be. And I think that one advantage the non-governments have, a not-for-profit sector, is that they can actually take that long-term view and continually advocate a position. And to do that, I think you actually also need to adopt politicians long before they get into those leadership roles. You need to be finding a way to get them to walk a mile in the people that you're helping shoes, and actually, so that when they get into those spots, if they get the opportunity to actually change something, there's a crisis that comes across and allows them to move the agenda forward, then they're ready to do it, and you know it's part of their DNA, to borrow a phrase from the debate tonight.
Yes, but politics still has the capacity to get you shafted, as you found out.
Oh, look, that's one of the joys of politics. The politics is full of ambition. It's full of people competing for ideas. It's full of people who are in there, I think, to do a good job, but have real disagreements about the way to do them, and sometimes it also gets lost in the short-term ambitions of politics. So it is a complicated and messy system, but I think, as Winston Churchill said, it's the best one we've got.
Susan, do you have any observations to Graham or question to Graham about the issues?
I think it'd be really interesting to hear Graham's reflections on how he thinks he could have worked differently with his colleagues to engage them more in the debate that he thought needed to be had to get the policy changes through. That'd be really fascinating.
Well, I think you certainly get wiser as you go along in politics. There's no doubt about that. And I think when I first got into politics close to about 10 years ago, I came in wanting to change the entire world. And perhaps what's needed is actually focus on some parts of it and concentrate on doing those. And I think one of the things you are as a politician is a real generalist. You're expected to be across a wide range of issues in your local area, and then as a minister you can have those portfolios changed very quickly. And I think that can be quite difficult to actually lead a reform and implement it if you haven't got that time to actually put it through. So I think coming in again, I would like to have probably identified a couple of areas that I was obviously interested in and passionate in, advocated a lot more on those, and perhaps that would have given me more of an opportunity when people gave me one of those roles to say, well, we know what he's going to be about in that area.
Frank.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting comment from Graham about that notion of specialisation and sort of long-term education of politicians, because I think one of the frustrations that we experience in the community sector and non-government sector is that it can be very difficult to work out how best to attempt to exercise influence over the political system. And I think one of the long-term prospects that we might have is to try and find some way in which longer-term policies can actually find a route, because the public servants who are actually servicing many of the politicians are also probably experiencing many of the same sorts of issues, that there are long-term problems and the bureaucracy is increasingly being called upon to manage the sort of short-term media cycle rather than those long-term policy issues. So I think it's incumbent on us to really address that problem in the longer term.
Graham, how did you find the bureaucracy in your circumstance? That is, you'd been working, I guess, with a team of bureaucrats to build towards a series of policy positions, and yet you still found, even with the weight of that, you couldn't get through.
Well, I think most public servants are really good and decent people. But I think they start off sceptical, like ministers, and you have to earn their trust, as you do with any organisation, I imagine, you enter into. And, of course, the risk for public servants can be quite great if they stick their neck out and it's not supported by their political patron. Then, of course, they can have that neck chopped off. So there's a process that goes on with the public service, not only to try and work out what your interests are, but also how genuine you are in actually willing to take a stand on these issues. And once that's established, I've always found that public servants in your departments are willing to go as hard as they can, and usually, by coincidence, I've been lucky to find that tends to agree with their general beliefs. But similarly, if they don't end up trusting their minister, then I can understand why they're not too prepared to actually take too many risks.
Mm. Paul McDonald, do you have any observations on Graham's observations?
Well, yes. Look, coming from 10 years in government prior to coming on into Anglicare Victoria, it's for politicians, I think, and observing that on the political side of things, it's very hard to be brave or bold or believing in a set of reforms and trying to push them through just amongst their colleagues within a state government or any government arrangement, really, with the pressure on them to probably not put your neck out or your chin out for in relation to policy reforms. On the public service side of things, you'll find a very keen public service, energised to want to bring things forward, but also very aware of sort of the limitations of, again, this thing that, you know, incremental improvement is a better way of going than rather large-scale reform, because it can create such scrutiny that governments and departments become shy about being bold in policy.
Don't give us the vision thing. Graham, just one final observation before we let you go. You watched the encounter tonight. Do you have a sort of vague feeling of sort of, oh dear, as you watched it roll through?
Interesting rather than exciting is probably how I'd categorise it. I'm sure MasterChef rated a lot more highly than it did.
Graham West, thank you very much. Graham West, Labor member of Campbelltown. Graham, thanks for joining the conversation on Sunday night.
Thank you, John.
It's interesting to get the comments of somebody like Graham into this situation. It does reinforce just how difficult it is. The issues that each of you have nominated, things like the jobless rate among young people, homelessness, the particular crisis of homelessness, despite Kevin Rudd's declaration at the start of his tenure, which is now, of course, usefully forgotten, that homelessness was going to be a priority, and the efforts of his minister, Tanya Plibersek, to do something about it. The global financial crisis and other things have meant that jobless rates have changed. In some sectors, you're going to get an increase in homelessness. You're getting people finding great difficulty with mortgages. So despite best efforts, politics can still roll over people. Yet we haven't heard a word about the homelessness agenda in this campaign at all. Susan?
Yeah, I've been disappointed with the lack of focus on the people that the Uniting Care Services work with. I mean, it feels like they're invisible, that these issues are long-term issues that need long-term solutions, but we have a short-term political cycle and we have a short-term attention span in the public media. I mean, what I was thinking when Graham was talking is that ministers and senior bureaucrats get very privileged access to lots of information, and it doesn't seem like we've set up our systems in a way that they can use that information well and make sure that information contributes to positive change in the lives of people that are disadvantaged. And I wonder whether that's just to do with these problems being long-term problems, but we only give them very short attention spans. I mean, the government has done very well in terms of investing billions of dollars in housing, but they can't fix the problem in a three-year time frame. We need to give a longer period of attention to it than that.
You're on Sunday night on ABC Radio Around Australia, on Radio Australia, and via the web to the world. If you'd like to join the conversation, please do. 1300 800 222. Your response to the great debate. Was it so great? Why was it ho-hum in what's happened to the vision thing? 1300 800 222. Do join us. Our guests in the studio are three of those who've been watching elections for many years, particularly with in mind those more disadvantaged in Australia, those who don't have a voice. Frank Quinlan is the Executive Director of Catholic Social Services. Susan Hellyer is the National Director of Uniting Care Australia. And Paul McDonald is the recently appointed CEO of Anglicare Victoria. 1300 800 222 is the number to ring if you've got opinions you'd like to share about the great debate. What were the highs and lows for you? What are your great disappointments? Do you think that politics is being played out as a game of rather shadow puppetry today? That we're not biting the real issues. In fact, politicians are running away from them as fast as they can. Before we take some calls, let me ask each of you your views on a phenomenon that seems to be playing out in a similar way in the United States to what it is, the way it is in Australia. And that's the issue of polarisation. You've seen, for example, in the United States, what used to be a Senate where people would sort of horse trade and walk around and sort of, you know, do deals for their sort of local electorates. And it was generally a sort of gentleman's club in which party allegiances were not held too strongly. And is to such an extent that in the United States Senate, it was accepted practice that 60% formed the majority, not 50%. Barack Obama has been faced with a new phenomenon in American politics, that is, ideological boundaries are becoming so firmly set on the Republican and Democrat side that it's proved impossible for him to operate on those normal old Senate lines, despite having a significant majority. This comes back to Frank Quinlan and Paul, your earlier observations about the role of the media here. Is polarisation settling in to such an extent that people dare not be even seen to be reaching out and dealing with issues in a substantive way, lest they be accused of deviating from the party line and costing votes among the faithful? Paul?
Well, look, John, I really think it's retarding our ability to come up with good and wise social policy or any other policy agenda issues at the moment. It really has restricted to a couple of PowerPoint dot points about this is our lines and this is how we're going to stay with them. The ability and the importance of having some collectivism around some of these hard structural issues seems to be really holding back where we need to go, either on housing reform or where we really could go in relation to family policy support. And I think while people are forced to, and often by party guidelines, forced to camp in these camps, I think, and also discredit anything else that moves outside these pretty tight frameworks, I think it's really restricting and retarding our ability, not only at government level, but publicly, to actually engage in the debate. And it's very little surprise that there's such lethargy about the lack of engagement in the debate. Part of it's media, I think, John, certainly, but it's also our ability, do we want to engage in this space? And I think that there's some lethargy there because of the limits and the restrictions and the retardations of the debate.
Frank Quinlan, I was thinking particularly in my own reflections on this about the way in which, for instance, in the United States, the debate's been polarised in the media between Fox taking one line on its news service and MSN taking the other line, and both of those camps fight the battle incredibly viciously. And are we beginning to see a hint of that creeping into the Australian media as well?
Look, I think we see more than a hint of that, really. I'd want to say two things. First, I would not want yet to discount the tremendous effort that politicians from all sides make on a large number of issues to negotiate and engage behind the scenes. And I think it's not reported, but I feel, like others in this group, very, very, very privileged, really, to be exposed to some of that Senate committee process and to be exposed to some of those discussions. And there is still, I think, a deep hunger in our politicians to be addressing some of these concerns in a sensible and bipartisan way. And I don't think we should discount that, because, I think there is hope in the fact that some of that still exists. I do think, however, though, that as we look at the media, it seems to me that what's occurring is that the media is less and less about reporting what it is that's going on, and is more about actually leading and setting the agenda and setting some of those traps that we talked about earlier. If you look at the time that was allocated to the debate tonight, the two leaders had, 5 minutes or something like that to introduce themselves and to introduce their issues. The large measure of the agenda then was set by Chris Yorman and by Malcolm Farr and by Laura Tingle. They had their list of questions. They set the agenda for tonight's debate in large measure. Props, 80% of the agenda tonight was set by three journalists. Now, I respect the three journalists, and they'll go hunting for a good story and a good angle and so on. But really, is that what we want? Or perhaps do we want Julia and Tony to have a chance to talk about their issues for 15 or 20 minutes? Yes. and really hear what that's about? But for whatever reason, I'm not even necessarily blaming the media as if there's some sort of malintent in all of this, but it's just somehow this rapid cycle, hunger for stories, hunger for quick conflicts and gotchas, I think is really retarding our capacity to address these issues in a sensible way.
Let's take some calls from Rick in Wollongong first. Hello, Rick. What would you like to say?
John and panel.
Yes.
I found the debate interesting, but I don't know what people expect. Do they expect, you know, we have nothing to fear but fear itself, like Roosevelt, or I have a drone speech by Dr. King? I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean, anyway...
What were you looking for?
Well, you know... Well, democracy is about promoting the dialogue within our continent, right? Within our communities and societies and within our continent. So, in a nutshell, someone else said democracy was something else, but...
You were satisfied with it?
Well, I like to see swinging voters read the transcript of the debate, see what they thought.
Leave it to the swing. We'll leave that as a comment.
Also,
yes, Rick?
And there's a lot of clichés, and I don't like people who use flippant remarks, especially comparing politicians to, what's that woman's name, capital of France? It's ridiculous. Anyway, as I was saying, and what's this business about real action? And
yes, are you a man of real action, I guess, is the Abbott phrase that trips off the tongue. And moving forward, which is Julia's phrase. Rick, thanks for your comment. We will move on. Lots of calls on the board. To Mari on the Central Coast. Hello, Mari. How are you? Mari, are you there? No, Mari slipped away from us. To Dennis in the Hunter Valley. Hello, Dennis. Welcome.
Yeah, hi. Just about the great debate. Just
yes.
A few things about it. I just think it was too predictable. Tony Abbott was bashing Labor, and Julie Gillard tried to actually bash Liberal there a bit. It's getting beyond a joke, they're bashing each other. But I did notice something with the turned it to Between the Ones with the Worms, and I noticed that when Julie Gillard started to speak, before she even mentioned any subject, the worm went up. And when Tony Abbott mentioned if we were elected without mentioning any subject at all, the worms went down. And a third thing I noticed about the worms is for two different stations had two different results for what's supposed to be the exact same audience. So I believe the ABC did the right thing in not having a worm there. However, it was just going around in circles with those policies. They're unimportant now. Sure, there might be... We've got a sort out legal markets of asylum seekers and genuine refugees, etc. However, as stated before, a lot more overstays illegal migrants get in here by plane. They don't concentrate on that. And issues I would like to see brought up is if they want clean power, nuclear power, and also bring up stem cell research. And even abortion, whether you agree or not agree, but I'm not saying that you should agree, I'm just saying those are the issues that should be brought up. But with this, and also another issue that should be brought up, unless it affects religion generally, is separating religion from politics.
Well, we can leave that one for another day, because it's a very big comment on that one. Let's move right along. Thanks for your call. We're on Sunday night on ABC Radio around Australia. If you'd like to join us, comments on the great debate. To Dennis. Hello, Dennis. We've just moved from Dennis to Vanessa. Hello, Vanessa. Welcome.
Oh, thank you. Hello. I don't really care about the worm, so I'm not here to talk about the worm. What I'm confused about, I was going to go for Julian, but I don't want to go for Abbott because I met Abbott 5 years ago at the Sacred Heart Mission, and he was all dressed up in his suit, and we all put balloons on for him, and he just stood there with a sausage, very unapproachable, and it was like, when's it time to leave? When's it time to leave? So I went to ask him a question as he was out to the car, and he goes, "Let's get out of here." Now that was at a place where homeless people go to eat, and goodness knows why they put streamers up and they put the best food on for him. It just doesn't make sense, because that's not how the homeless live in our underfunded welfare crisis going on in Melbourne. I've got two schizophrenics that are homeless, and I have another schizophrenic that has a drug issue that they don't want to know about because he's got a mental illness and a drug issue, and not Tony Abbott or Julian has mentioned one word about this long-term welfare system that's going way down to the ground.
We'll take that as a comment also from Vanessa in Brighton. Thanks, Vanessa, for that. Yes, everybody wants to comment. Nobody wants to ask questions. If any of you have got questions, please ring them through right now. 1-300-800-222. Lots of calls, and we'll sprint through a few right now. To Chris in Double Bay. Hello, Chris. Welcome.
Hello, John. How are you?
Yeah, good.
John, I suppose it's a comment as well rather than a question, but I regarding the homeless, I came across a situation recently where a large property in the western suburbs had gone into receivership with something like 300 rooms in it, and it could have been purchased for a very reasonable price. And I wrote to the minister, respective minister, federal minister, and made that suggestion to her that about two-thirds of those rooms could have been occupied on a, say, a short-term basis, 3 to 6 months for homeless people. And the balance of the property could have been used to set up as a trade centre for apprenticeships and that type of thing. I got a letter back about 3 months later directing me to discuss it with the New South Wales government. Now, there was nothing in it for me. It was just a spontaneous thought I had, and I thought it was something where the government could do something and make a real difference. And I don't understand why action isn't taken when the benefit is going to the homeless people. I just, you know, there's no politics involved in it. It's just for the benefit of the unfortunate.
Yes,
so I wondered if any of you people had a thought on that. And I suppose it's difficult to get the wheels of government to respond quickly. That's one of the big problems we have in this country.
Yeah. Paul, do you want to take that one up, having worked both sides of the fence here?
Yes. Well, look, we have some real stock and capacity issues in this country in relation to housing. Real big structural questions to answer about how. I mean, there's certainly some reasonable reform policy papers being put by this government at the moment. But really, at the end of the day, you've got 180,000, even in this state, in Victoria, on public housing waiting lists. You've got 80% of families in seeking temporary accommodation who seek it are being turned away. And unless we deal with the fundamental stock and capacity and access into housing, you know, agencies like United Care, Catholic Services, or ourselves and Anger Care are going to have waiting rooms full up of people needing to get into temporary and very and not only unaffordable housing, but really inhabitable housing in many respects. And I think what you're asking really is fundamentally, it is a question of capacity, stock, and access. And
well, we yes, Paul, but not. Excuse me, basically, but this was a situation that was there where 200 rooms could have been used basically within a week.
Mm.
And it didn't require a lot of money. And yet it took 3 months for the government just to get back to me and say, direct this proposition to the state government. And I thought, well, I just watched a Four Corners program on homeless people in the western suburbs, you know. Yeah,
if I could comment, though, on that, Chris, one of the things that I think is feeding into this, it's similar to the... in my view, the media setting the agenda for the debate. One of the things that happens to governments of any persuasion, I think, and state and federal governments, is that they become so averse to this exposure to the gotcha. So I'm not suggesting this is the case in your case, Chris, but let's say the minister decided very quickly to buy the premises, and it turned out that, you know, there was a link somewhere to some political party or to some apparatchik, or that you turned out not to be an honest and decent fellow, but somebody who was taking them for a ride. They become so averse to that that it does, I think, make it very, very difficult for governments to act quickly and act swiftly around some of these problems, even with the best of will. And I'm not trying to make excuses. I'd like to think that governments of all kinds are, you know, going to be quick to respond to opportunities when they come up. But I do think it's part of this bigger problem about if they trip over, you know, that minister's likely to be for another job next week.
The other thing, Chris, I was interested in hearing is I've just been to New South Wales to visit some of our services, and some services in Western Sydney, you know, had some ideas about how they'd like to build community facilities for unmet need, particularly young people, homelessness, those kinds of issues. And it, you know, and the government had rolled out a stimulus package that enabled resources to be allocated to those kinds of needs, but the resources just are never enough, are they? And so there's an enormous amount of people that are out there looking for opportunities to better meet the community's needs, but there's always a limited pie. And I think that's part of the thing that we all argue for when we work with government, is around making sure the pie is big enough to meet demand and to meet the community's needs. And one of the big gaps at the moment is around community infrastructure. There just isn't enough infrastructure out there to respond to the needs that are in the community.
Enough infrastructure or enough money?
I guess they're tied together, aren't they? Because you need both the right kind of buildings and the right kind of places for people, as well as the kind of resources that will provide the services once the people are there.
Chris, thanks for your call. We're going to have to move on. A very useful contribution to the debate. Thank you. That's Chris in Double Bay. Let's take a call from Jennifer in Hobart. Hello, Jennifer. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. I hope you're all well.
Well, I'm fine. Tell us what your concerns are.
My concern is that it wasn't actually a debate. I thought a debate was the for and against and, you know, on various subjects. Now, there was not a pertinent question asked. Now, were those questions pre-written or what?
No, they weren't. The journalists don't give them a preview.
Well, they were pathetic. Absolutely pathetic. I studied political science at university, and politics now have no bearing whatsoever on what I call politics.
What were the issues for you then that you would
raise? The issues for me were, we heard moving forward, we've heard it all before. There wasn't a word said we hadn't heard before. I am extremely disturbed in the fact that the hospital situations weren't discussed, what sort of situation they were going to go ahead for homeless people, as we were speaking of earlier. And I do not understand this. Perhaps I'm stupid, but I cannot understand all this idiocy with East Timor and boat people, and is it to put us off the track of something else? Because, good God, the amount of boat people coming here and is neither here nor there. Just bring them to Australia, have a good look at them, get them to fill into some forms. If they don't come up to scratch, send them back.
Jennifer, we're going to have to leave you there because we're running out of time. Jennifer, with an adequate summary, I think, of the frustration that most people are feeling. Frank Quinlan, it's been great to have you with us this evening. It's been excellent to have Susan Hellyer with us again.
Thanks,
and,
John.
And good to be introduced to Paul McDonald, recently appointed CEO of Anglicare Victoria.
Thanks, John.
If you'd like to pick up this conversation, you can in our final hour when we'll be joined by Samina Yasmin. But to you all, each of you, Frank and Susan and Paul, as this election campaign unfolds, we do trust that some of the issues that you're vitally concerned with, those who can't get their voices heard onto the agenda, do make it. We are, after all, a country who I think we're supposed to be judged by the way we treat the least amongst us. Let's hope we still are. You're on Sunday night on ABC Radio around Australia. This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. Thank you for listening.